GoDaddy.com. Use the code POD139, that's POD139, for 10% off GoDaddy hosting. GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1526, June 21, 2011.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you from home. I got home actually yesterday. I thought I was going to get home earlier in the day, but I unloaded up in Bentonville, Arkansas, at one of the Walmart warehouses up there, probably the largest one, great big place. And the delivery appointment was set for 6 a.m., and I got there right at 5 a.m., or a couple of minutes, just maybe a few minutes after 5 a.m., and yesterday morning, yesterday being Sunday, and so there early Sunday morning, and so, you know, I got backed into the door by about 6 o'clock, it might have been a little bit before 6 a.m., and then the wait started. Finally got out of there at noon. Noon. I was there for 6 hours. Well, actually, I was there for 7 hours, the better part of 7 hours. But certainly backed into the dock for 6 hours. And, you know, that I thought day or two or three ago, I was at some Walmart warehouse. Now, I don't quite remember where it was, but I was there for 4 hours. And I thought that was the worst that was the longest I'd ever been in a Walmart warehouse waiting to get unloaded. Well, in this case, it was 6 hours. And that's ridiculous. But once again, it was one of these loads where, you know, just really, I mean, little, you know, 100 of this and 50 of that and 20 of this and 30 of that, and a really complicated load with literally dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of items, page after page after page of breakdown, and a load like that is obviously, if they just, depends kind of on how many people they put on it, let's say they just put one person on it, it's going to take that one person hours. Now, maybe they put more than one person on it, I don't know, but It certainly took a long time, because they have to go through and kind of count everything and perhaps sort it and restack it, obviously. And so it's, you know, quite a lengthy process. So in any case, I finally got out of there and made it home. I guess it was by around 1 p.m. yesterday afternoon. Now, I'm sitting outside on my back deck, and unfortunately the air conditioner is running now, so you're going to have to listen to the air conditioner running for a bit until it shuts back off. But and it's a little windy. There's a little bit of a breeze blowing now. And typically, this back part of my yard here is pretty well protected. And so if the wind is blowing here, then it means it's really blowing out in more open areas. And it's actually died down because earlier today it was... it's been blowing all day, so earlier today it was blowing harder. This evening it's kind of calmed down somewhat, but it's still somewhat windy. But it's not bad. I'm guessing the temperature It's kind of hard to guess, right? I'd say it's in somewhere probably in the upper 70s, and it's relatively humid. I don't know what the humidity is, but it's a little humid, not terrible, but it is somewhat humid. So, but anyway, made it home yesterday afternoon, and then my parents are here. They'd come up here, upwards of 2 weeks ago, but maybe about a week and a half ago. They came up here for the summer, basically, and so, of course, they're living now in South Texas, and then they come up here for the summer and pretty much stay in my house most of the time. That, you know, I've got an extra bedroom, and that's basically their bedroom, and so they just kind of pretty much occupy my house, which is fine. I'm happy with that. And plus, they have a small motorhome that they leave here, and so they kind of go back and forth, but they're pretty much sleeping in my house at this, you know, right now. But in any case, my mom had a dinner, because yesterday was Father's Day. She had a dinner, and both of my younger brothers came, and parts of their family came. So it wasn't a huge, and then my dad's youngest sister. And so it wasn't a huge gathering, but it was, family dinner. And so that, enjoyed that. And then so today, she had another smaller dinner. She invited dad's youngest sister, and then a brother-in-law, one of dad's brother-in-laws that's now a widower, and so invited them over. And so I kind of hung around and had lunch with them, because otherwise I would have probably went to Bella Vista, and had lunch with my friend Gene up there. But I may do that tomorrow. So otherwise, I've just been I did go down to the post office and to the bank, and I had to run a little short errand. But otherwise, I've just kind of been hanging out here at the house and relaxing. Now, I was exhausted. Well, because of that schedule, that delivery schedule yesterday, I had stopped there about 15 miles south of Joplin, Missouri, that little fuel stop, and so I ended up going to bed. It was like, I don't know, it was like 1:30, and then I had my alarm set for 3:30, so I probably got maybe a good hour and a half worth of sleep, and I woke up before the alarm went off, and so I slept probably a good hour and a half, and then did not sleep while I was waiting to unload. There were a couple other drivers there, and I ended up kind of getting into some, lengthy conversations with them, and I pretty much was just kind of waiting the entire time. And so then last night I went to bed, it's kind of exhausted. I went to bed around 7:30. It was still a little bit of daylight, but I went ahead and went to bed. And then slept really well. Woke up, I guess it was about 4:30 a.m. this morning, and I went ahead, and I was wide awake at that point, so I went ahead and got up, and this afternoon around 4 o'clock, I was kind of out of gas. And so I laid down on the bed, and I ended up, which I probably shouldn't have done, but I did. I laid down on the bed, and I ended up sleeping for about 3 hours. So I woke up around 7 or so, and I went ahead and got back up. And then, of course, now I'm wide awake. So, I'm going to try to get to bed. It's kind of hard, once you get your schedule. Once I get my schedule kind of messed up, it's kind of hard straightening it back out. So, anyhow, I was, you know, I've got this Nook color, and I've been obviously continuing to play with it. There's that website, rootnookcolor.com, and I got I was able to get the SD card of the, you know, and then boot off the SD card. You know, there's different versions of Android that you can get that have kind of been optimized for a tablet. And so, you know, this Nook Color is a nice piece of hardware. It's got some extra features in it that Barnes & Noble has not so far turned on. For example, it does have Bluetooth. It's got Bluetooth capability. But it may have just been thrown in as part of, you know, the hardware package. Because at this point, I've kind of been able to turn it on, but it really is sort of semi-functional at best. And I don't know if it's really a software issue, where there's some sort of software interference that, you know, that's kind of preventing it. Or you just heard a motorcycle go by out on the highway. Don't know if it's a software issue or if there's some sort of hardware issue, because they may have made some compromises in the design of this thing, you know, in order to keep the price low as possible. You know, they were more concerned with the screen. It's got a very nice screen, 7-inch widescreen, very nice screen for reading and what have you, pretty high resolution, and very bright and colorful. And then, of course, the Wi-Fi works really well, but the Bluetooth is kind of iffy. So I'm beginning to wonder if the Bluetooth, you know, people have been able to get it to work, but how reliable is it? So, but that's not really that critical. It's just, you know, I'd kind of like to, you know, I'm just, at this point, I'm kind of experimenting with it. But one thing that I did do today, I've spent a lot of time outside, where I am right now, actually, sort of, you know, bringing this thing out here and just kind of playing with it and reading things and kind of consuming things that I might ordinarily consume on the computer. And kind of what as I kind of get into the tablet experience more and more, I'm realizing that as the use of tablets grow, that is going to be changing people's behavior as far as what they're consuming from the internet. I think it really is going to end up changing behaviors, and obviously that's going to have, over time, it's going to end up having kind of profound implications for what is popular on the internet. And so that is going to, this tablet thing is going to end up driving content. And so that's probably going to be one of the next articles that I end up writing on geeknewscentral.com. I haven't written any for, probably 3 weeks now, because I just really hadn't, for about the last 3 weeks, I really haven't felt compelled to write any articles. But now I think this is probably going to end up being the next article, and it's going to be kind of, you know, about this general topic of tablets and what it's going to end up doing as far as kind of driving the evolution of the internet and driving content, because it was obvious that it was kind of pushing towards smartphones and handheld devices, but the tablet type handheld, so-called handheld device, which it is, you know, it is kind of a handheld device to an extent. Or you can kind of prop it up on a table in front of you, that is going to end up driving things as well. And so the more, in other words, I guess, the more portable the internet becomes, and the more portable consumption devices there are, the more that is going to end up driving what ends up happening ultimately with it, with the content. But it's sort of a continuation of the evolution of improved communications, because you know, we have improved communications, and you can, so you know, with the internet itself, and we're now to the point where you kind of got wireless everywhere. You're ending up with the kind of sort of a wireless broadband everywhere, you know, I guess in the guise of 3G, but it has dramatically improved, and it's kind of available in way more places than ever. So it's sort of ubiquitous at this point, and that's improved, and hopefully will continue to improve. But then the other part of the equation is that the devices that we're receiving the internet on are also continuing to change and improve. And so instead of having to sit in front of a computer screen to read an article, I can just take the screen itself with me in a more portable form. And not only is it a screen, but it's a touch screen. It's a multimedia playback device that's capable of doing all kinds of interesting things. It's primarily as a consumption device. And so as that continues to evolve, that's going to continue to drive the changes. So, pretty interesting. So I don't know. At first, I didn't think that I needed, I couldn't see where I really needed a device like this. But now that I've got one and I've had it for a little while, and I've been able to consume media on it as far primarily either browsing or reading books or what have you, I'm beginning to understand that I really probably do, you know, I can evolve a need for it, because it, you know, instead of being kind of forced to consume stuff on the computer, you know, I can kind of take this thing with me. It's very portable, and consume the stuff right there. You know, and obviously the computer's still there for certain things. I don't think computers are going to go away, but a more portable device obviously does lend itself to different types of uses, and that's going to end up, as I say, it's going to kind of end up changing what people are looking for, or what people are sort of demanding, what people are sort of consuming as far as an online experience. So, but it is a continuing evolution, and then sort of a continuing refinement that's occurring because of the fact that the devices themselves are continuing to miniaturize and get less expensive, and the technology continues to improve. This, with, you know, this sort of the rapid adoption of all this touchscreen technology, and you know, and that's the area that is kind of competing in, and so it really is the touchscreen iPad type experience really is a very natural, pretty much a very natural way to consume media. So now I know there's going to be people out there that are saying, I told you. I've been trying to tell you. And yep, well, you have. So, but I don't know. At first, I didn't really see that I had a need for something like this. But in some cases, you don't really realize that you could have a need for something until you actually begin to use it. And typically, what happens with things like this, you have early adopters, and then if the early adopters kind of early adopt, and then if it works out, then you'll end up with mass adoption. And that's, I think we're kind of in the mass adoption phase at this point. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if you look at look back at the history of consumer electronics, then there's it's gone through these phases. You know, you look at the VCR, the DVD player, you know, computers, different types of computers, so on and so forth. This is just, as I say, it's kind of a continuing refinement or evolution of computer technology, but it's it does represent kind of a fundamental change. It's more than just a new type of computer, because because you can take it with you. You know, in other words, I can, you know, one of the complaints with computers is, well, how am I going to take it into the bathroom with me? You know, it just doesn't quite work. I still need a magazine or a book in the bathroom. Well, you get the right portable screen that you can take with you to the, you know, that does all this stuff that you can kind of take to the bathroom with you, or take to bed with you, or, you know, if you want to read something or do some, you know, that type of thing, consume media. Then that obviously that, you know, that then the whole book idea or magazine idea sort of ends up changing. And as I say, it kind of ends up, it's going to ultimately end up changing what people are actually consuming, kind of not only how they consume it, but what they actually consume. So, kind of interesting. So, I don't know. At some point, I might buy an iPad. So, we'll see. Anyway, I found this article. It's actually, you know, it's got like five parts. And it's on there's this German newspaper. I think it's a newspaper. It's called Der Spiegel. And so, they have an English version of it here. And they've got this article. It's really quite an interesting article about the European, you know, the euro, which is the, you know, the money, and you know, and the eurozone nations and what have you. And I'm just going to go ahead and read through this and I'll probably comment on it as I go, but this article does a really good job of sort of laying out what has been going on in Europe and with, you know, the Greek debt crisis, so on and so forth. So anyway, in the past 14 months, politicians in the Eurozone nations have adopted one bailout package after the next, convening for hectic summit meetings, wrangling over lazy compromises, and building up risks of gigantic dimensions. For just as long, they have been avoiding an important conclusion, that things cannot continue this way. The old euro no longer exists in its intended form, and the European Monetary Union isn't working. We need a plan B. Instead, those in responsible positions are getting bogged down in crisis management as they seek to placate the public and sugarcoat the problems. They say there is only a government debt crisis in a few euro countries, but no euro crisis, citing as evidence the fact that the value of the European common currency has remained relatively stable against other currencies like the dollar. But if it wasn't for the euro, Greece's debt crisis would be an isolated problem, one that was tough for the country but easy for Europe to bear. It's only because Greece is part of the eurozone that Athens' debts are a problem for all of its partners and pose a threat to the common currency. If the rest of Europe abandons Greece, the crisis could spin out of control, spreading from one weak eurozone country to the next. Investors would have no guarantee that Europe would not withdraw its support from Portugal or Ireland if push came to shove, and they would sell their government bonds. The prices of these bonds would fall, and risk premiums would go up. Then these countries would only be able to drum up fresh capital by paying high interest rates, which would only augment their existing budget problems. It's possible that they would no longer be able to raise any money at all, in which case they would become insolvent. But if the current situation continues, the monetary union will invariably turn into a transfer union, a path the inventors of the euro were determined to prevent. Democratic deficiencies. The euro's founding fathers did not anticipate such a crisis. Why, no, they didn't think anything like this could happen. Why, how could that be? And thus did not include any provisions for the European Monetary Union's set of regulations. The euro wheels together strong and weak countries for better or worse. There is no emergency exit, and there are no rules to follow in an emergency. Only the hope that everything will turn out well in the end. This is why the crisis of a few euro countries are a crisis for the euro, as well as a crisis for the European Union, its governments, and its institutions. And this is why the euro crisis has suddenly and unexpectedly mushroomed into a crisis for the political project, Europe, its future, and its cohesion. The fact that the countries funding the bailouts are lacking democratic legitimization is now becoming the greatest impediment to joint crisis management. Gone are the days of subtle debate over whether European Parliament involves citizens is in a just and proportional way. In the decisions reached by the European Council, the body headed by the leaders of the European Union member states and the European Commission and the EU's executive, when things get serious as they are now, decisions will no longer be made by the somewhat democratically legitimized EU bodies, but at the more or less secret meetings of a handful of leaders. See, they're in a dictatorship. They're in a dictatorship. During the German chancellor's and the French president's quiet walks together and at the behind-the-scenes meetings of discreet central banks, policies are being made that are then handed to the parliaments to rubber stamp, even though hardly any of their members understand them. The costly decisions that are ultimately reached by the luminaries of European solidarity don't just affect citizens of the ailing member states in an existential way. They must also fear for their social security, their jobs, and their assets. The decisions of European politicians are just as troubling for citizens who live, like the Germans, on the sunny side of the Union and are worried that their country is running up debt that could remain on the books into a remotely distant future. One of the reasons that Europeans are so incensed at their respective governments is that they are not involved in the decision-making process. Another is that they inevitably perceive their political leaders as being motivated by alleged factual constraints and the requirements of the financial markets without having any plan of their own. The euro debt crisis has already swept aside two governments in Ireland and Portugal, and the Spanish and Greek governments could soon follow. Things are also getting precarious for the governments in Berlin, where Chancellor Angela Merkel could lose her parliamentary majority in upcoming votes on bailout measures. Resistance to austerity measures. A crack now bisects the continent, running between those countries that need more and more and more money and those that are expected to pay. With the Greeks frustrated over the Germans and the Germans over the Greeks, the Portuguese, the Spaniards, and the Italians, the political peace project of European unity threatens to end in a great economic dispute among the nations. In the debtor countries, there is growing resistance against the constant barrage of new austerity programs, while the people of the creditor countries are increasingly incensed over the billions in new aid. The outraged citizens are taking to the streets in Madrid and Athens, while the true Finns gain strength in the parliament in Helsinki. Some 60% of Germans are opposed to a new aid package for Greece, and there is at least as much resistance among the opposition and trade unions in Athens to the government's efforts to rein in spending, a precondition for additional loans. Last Wednesday, thousands of Greeks staged a general strike intended to block access to the parliament building, where the new austerity program was being debated. Prime Minister Georgios Papandreou's limousine was showered with oranges, while rocks were thrown elsewhere. The police used tear gas to protect the elected representatives from the people they represent. To secure payment of the next loan tranche under the European aid package, Papandreou intends to put together another austerity package worth more than 6.5 billion euro, or $9.3 billion. By the end of the month, the protesters outside the parliament building, unwilling to accept the prime minister's course of action, shouted, "Thieves, traitors, what's happened to our money?" How long will citizens in weak euro countries, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and Spain, continue to accept the harsh reforms? And how long will voters in the creditor countries tolerate their own governments taking even higher risks to rescue the euro? The euro has become the greatest threat to the continent's future. Finland is a country that is often held up as a successful model for other European countries, but the success of the right-wing populists, the true Finns, who captured 20% of the vote in April's parliamentary elections, came as a wake-up call to the political establishment in Brussels. As the skeptics gain ground through the EU, anti-European sentiments are growing in even the core countries of the Union, like France and Germany. The euro, created with the aim of permanently uniting Europe, has become the greatest threat to the continent's future. A collapse of the monetary union would set Europe back by decades, dealing it a blow from which it might never recover, especially with Europe's position already threatened by the fast-growing Asian economies. How is a fragmented Europe to prevail against this new competition? This is why Europe's politicians want to defend the euro at all costs, and while they are approving one bailout package after the next, they are playing for time, hoping that the markets will settle down and the reforms will take hold. That's ridiculous. It's not going to happen. Greece is, a ridiculous example. It's like someone that's on welfare and you keep giving them more and more and more and more, you know, because all these people are you got all these people that, you know, are government-owned companies in Greece, and, you know, and so they pay them, and, you know, you got all these labor unions, and people are, you know, they're not producing, and yet they still want money. And Greece is a welfare case. Let's see here. The business community is supporting their efforts too in a major advertising campaign scheduled to run in leading publications this week. Top German business executives, including ThyssenKrupp chairman Gerhard Krom, Siemens CEO Peter Loscher, and Daimler CEO Dieter Zetsche, I'm mispronouncing that, promotes the monetary union and insist the euro is necessary. They argue that ailing member states must be assisted financially and that the common currency is absolutely worth this commitment. The euro is a fair-weather construct. But the causes of the euro crisis are more deep-seated than that. The monetary union is a fair-weather construct. As a number of economists said from the beginning, American economist Milton Friedman, for example, predicted that the euro would not survive its first major crisis. And later in 2002, he added, Euroland will collapse in 5 to 15 years. For these reasons, the euro crisis, as suddenly as it occurred, was expected. However, the warnings had been ignored and treated as a minor nuisance. More than anything, the euro was a political project. Its advocates, most notably German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, and then French President François Mitterrand, wanted to permanently unite the continent's core countries and embedded Germany, which many neighboring countries perceived as a threat following reunification, in the European community. Politicians hoped that as a result of the common currency, the underlying problems of the euro's design would resolve itself, namely that the member states would almost automatically settle in at the same pace of economic development. See, they want everybody to be the same. It's not fair that some countries like Germany or France are more advanced and, you know, they're better, and these other countries like Greece are slower, and it's just not fair. You know, and so this is basically, it's kind of like a Soviet Union. You know, we're going to push all these people together and try to force them, to, you know, kind of externally force them to all get along is basically what this is about. And you know, and they can kind of push this because, they're enslaving them. And, you know, the reason that they're enslaved is because they're enslavable. That's the way it works. If you're enslavable, then there's going to be somebody that's going to come along and enslave you. Anyway, this goes on. It was a deceptive hope. In fact, it was only interest rates that converged now that the European Central Bank, the ECB, was setting uniform rates for strong and weak members alike throughout the entire economic zone. As a result, a great deal of capital flowed to Spain and Ireland, where a real estate bubble developed, while the Greeks and the Portuguese were able to live shamelessly beyond their means. They imported more than they exported and took on more new debt to pay for their consumption. This behavior continued unabated until the financial crisis put an end to it. Suddenly, money was scarce. The bubbles in Ireland and Spain burst. The economy in the Eurozone collapsed. And the Greeks were forced to admit their debts were much higher than they had ever disclosed before, and that they had falsified their numbers from the beginning and should, in fact, never have been allowed to join the monetary union in the first place. Has the euro pushed Europe apart? Since then, the monetary union has been on the brink of collapse. Far from growing together economically, Europe has, in fact, grown even further apart. As a result, the chances that the euro will survive its current form are slimmer than ever. Politicians who ignore the laws of economics cannot go unpunished in the long run. If national currency still existed, countries like Greece and Portugal could resort to a proven means of reducing their lack of competitiveness. They would simply have to devalue their drachma or their escudo. And then the laws of supply and demand would see to it that the flow of commodities was diverted. The price of Greek and Portuguese products would go down to make them more marketable abroad. At the same time, money would be worth less in Athens or Lisbon, so that residents of those countries could afford to buy fewer imported goods. This would be beneficial for the trade balance. Exports would rise, so that and so would the foreign currency revenues, allowing countries to service their debts more effectively. Not the government, but the markets would reduce economic imbalances. But in a monetary union, the exchange rate is no longer available as an adjustment valve. Instead, the member countries must regain their competitiveness in different ways, namely by imposing tough austerity measures and reducing wages and prices. In a monetary union, it is up to the governments to enforce what the exchange rate would do in a system of competing currencies muddling through. If this fails, the mountain of debt will continue to grow. In the end, a country with a large deficit has three options. First, it can declare itself insolvent and, after restructuring its debt, attempt to rebuild its economy. Secondly, it can also withdraw from the monetary union and reintroduce its national currency. Third, it can convince creditor countries to keep issuing new loans, thereby providing it with permanent financing, and then it can be a permanent welfare case. I added that last part. For more than a year now, European governments have been trying out a fourth option, muddling through. And for just as long, politicians have been assuring the people that this approach is the alternative and that it will end up costing taxpayers nothing at all because the ailing countries will repay the debt with interest and compound interest once they've been bailed out. Oh, sure, that's right. If you owe too much money, the solution's just to borrow more. Right, that works, sure. In fact, they argue with the whole thing is even good business arrangement for the rescuers. Right, there you go. Loan the money to the deadbeats. The truth is that governments and monetary watchdogs, despite all the protestations to the contrary, have continually expanded their bailout programs, have built up massive risks that could significantly burden future generations, and have violated both the European treaties and the ironclad principles of the ECB. To date, the history of the Euro rescue program has not been a successful one. In fact, it is more of a history of mistakes and broken promises. There will be no budgetary funds for Greece. On March 1, 2010, Chancellor Merkel's spokeswoman said a clear no, there will be no budgetary funds for Greece. At that point, Athens was on the verge of bankruptcy. And politicians with Germany's center-right Christian Democratic Union, the CDU, and pro-business Free Democracy Party, FDP, were suggesting that the country sell off a few islands. On May 2nd, the Euro countries and the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, approved a 110 billion euro bailout package for the beleaguered country. Although the German portion of the loans was coming from the government-owned development bank KfW and was not the budget, the federal government still served as a guarantor. Every euro the Greeks do not repay will constitute a burden on the German taxpayer. It was the first violation of European treaties which categorically rule out aid payments to needy euro countries. This so-called no bailout clause was intended to guarantee that monetary union didn't become a transfer union. It's called a welfare state, and that the strong wouldn't have to pay for the weak. It was crucial to the acceptance of the treaty by the national parliaments. Without the German parliament, the Bundestag would not have agreed to the monetary union. They got hoodwinked. They were scammed. The second lapse occurred soon afterwards on May 9, 2010. The first euro bailout fund was launched, although the volume of 440 billion euros alone made it clear that the opposite was the case. Merkel and Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble tried to downplay the importance of the European Financial Stability Fund, EFSF. They insisted that the fund was purely a precaution, would not be used, and most of all was temporary. An extension of the current bailout funds will not happen on Germany's watch, Merkel said in Brussels on September 16, 2010. This promise, too, only lasted a few months. On March 25, 2011, the leaders of the Eurozone approved a new constant crisis mechanism. Although it has a different name, the European Stability Mechanism, or ESM, it will function on the basis of the same principle as its predecessor fund, the EFSF. Beginning in mid-2013, the Euro countries want to pry loose €700 billion for the fund, which will include a cash contribution. For the first time, the Germans will be asked to pay at least 22 billion euros. To do so, Germany will have to take on additional debt. Well, that's great. How wonderful for the Germans. Outcome is, very close to a transfer union. As if this weren't enough, in March, the Eurozone member states also agreed that both the current bailout fund, the EFSF, and its successor, the ESM, would be authorized to buy government bonds from bankruptcy candidates with low credit ratings in the future. As a result, countries living beyond their means will no longer be punished with high interest rates, and market mechanisms will be eroded. Even the CDU's Michael Meister, one of the financial policy experts loyal to Merkel, says the outcome comes very close to a transfer union, which we reject. As all assurances aside, performance in return for Germany's willingness to play along would be absent again and again. Representative of Merkel's government coalition, government in Berlin, have outdone each other in calling for strict penalties for countries that violate the Eurozone's deficit rules. There was talk of eliminating voting rights of that ain't going to do any good. It's already a dictatorship. What's that going to do? Of freezing EU subsidies like the bloated agriculture fund, and as a last dissolution, even the exclusion up from the monetary union. Most of all, however, the penalties were to be imposed automatically in the future when a country's budget deficit exceeded 3% of its gross domestic product. We support the greatest amount of automation as possible, making it automatic, Merkel said in the September 2010. After taking a walk with French President Nicolas Sarkozy in the French seaside resort of Deauville, the chancellor abandoned the position and the deficit process was to be triggered automatically. Instead, the finance ministers in the Eurozone must set it in motion first, meaning that any decision would be subject to the usual horse trading in Brussels. A clear market reaction. The reaction by the markets to what is the biggest failure to date in the efforts to rescue the euro has been very clear. The yields for Greek and Irish government bonds rose and Ireland sought protection from the bailout fund in November 2010, followed by Portugal in April 2011. In recent months, the governments of the Eurozone countries have gradually expanded their bailout programs, and the risks for the German people and the taxpayers have grown with each step. There are already estimates of how much the Greek crisis will truly end up costing the German taxpayers if the crisis drags on for years or a debt haircut becomes necessary. Economist Assange Belke of the University of Duisburg-Essen and Christian Dreger of Vedrina University in Frankfurt and Der Order estimate the cost at about 40 billion euros. The Cologne Institute for Economic Research, the IW, estimates the cost to German taxpayers at 65 billion euro if Portugal, Ireland, and Spain also become insolvent. In the event of a complete collapse of the Eurozone, Germany would be liable for all the guarantees and bailout aid it has provided. And the potential cost for the German taxpayers wouldn't stop there, because they are also indirectly affected by the risks lurking in the accounts of the ECB and the state-controlled banks. Since May 2010, the ECB has spent 75 billion euro purchasing government bonds from ailing euro countries. Its goal was to bring calm to the markets and prevent the risk premiums for the bonds from skyrocketing, but many used the opportunity to unload the risky securities on the central bank. The ECB is believed to have spent 40 to 50 billion euro to date on the Greek government bonds. In addition, as of the end of April, it had refinanced Greek banks to the tune of 90 billion euros. Hardly anyone knows how high the risks are for the ECB. It all has also accepted 480 billion euros in, quote, structured securities from banks as collateral. The euro crisis has already turned into a threat to the ECB. German taxpayers bear 27% of the risk, which corresponds to the German Bundesbank share of ECB capital. Back at the brink, despite all of these bailout measures and despite the risks that their rescuers have assumed, the weak euro countries are back where they were a little over a year ago, namely on the brink. The risk premiums of their government bonds have climbed to new record highs. The Greeks need fresh cash to avert bankruptcy, and the risk of the crisis spreading to other euro countries is far from averted. The aid that euro countries and the IMF have provided to Greece so far is not enough. They have naively assumed that the crisis would end quickly, and they had seriously anticipated that the Greeks would return to the capital markets within the next 2 years in order to raise about 60 billion euro on their own. The money is missing because the Greek government, despite all of its reform efforts, is still not seen as credit worthy. This is why the funding gap needs to be closed, including with fresh money from the Europeans. In return, the Greeks must fulfill even more stringent requirements. Given the Greek government crisis, achieving this seems more uncertain than ever. When the first bailout package of 110 billion euros was approved, Athens reacted with tough measures. Pensions were slashed, tobacco, petroleum, and value-added taxes were drastically increased, and it was made easier for companies to lay off workers. So they're doing all their this is all kind of the planned economy. We're going to do this, we're going to do that. It's all a dictatorship. And people do not, you know, when you start raising taxes, people do not just mindlessly continue to do what they did before. Things change. People act dynamically. And of course, these idiot planners that plan all this stuff just assume that, everybody, that they can just force everybody just to continue, you know, to kind of mechanically make them do what they did in the past, and it doesn't work that way. Nevertheless, Prime Minister Papandreou failed to meet the targets set by the so-called Troika, consisting of the IMF, the ECB, and the European Commission, and the EU's executive arm. A maximum budget deficit of 8.1% of GDP has been stipulated for 2010, but in the end, the deficit was 10.5%. After a strong start in the summer of 2010, the implementation of the reforms has come to a standstill in recent quarters, the Troika concludes in its latest report. It also states that the gap between the planned and the actual deficit has once again grown significantly in recent months. There are many holy cows that were not slaughtered, explained Jens Bastian, an economist living in Athens. While more than 200,000 jobs were cut nationwide, many state-owned companies in particular are seen as gold mines when it comes to sinecures. In contrast, those privileged Greeks working in state-owned companies and government agencies, more and more people are now forced to live on small pensions or minimum wage earnings of 750 to 800 euros a month, plus bonuses. Such incomes were hardly enough to live on in the past, and now they are to be reduced across the board or offset by drastic increases in the rate of tax on consumer goods. Suffering and sacrifices in Greece. People don't know why they are suffering and making these sacrifices, says Athens political science professor Sephrodis. The privilege of being in the Eurozone is losing more and more of its value for people because they benefit less and less from it. Almost 30% of Greeks would prefer to return to the drachma sooner than rather than later. Now the government will have to approve additional austerity measures if it is to obtain fresh cash from the EU and the IMF in the form of a second aid package worth between 90 billion and 120 billion euros for the period until 2014. Greece will have to pay off old debts and make new ones. The government debt is currently about 150% of GDP and will likely rise to 160% soon. How can such a weak country ever pay off such a huge debt? For once, almost all economists agree it will be impossible without debt restructuring involving creditors writing off large parts of their debts. But a so-called haircut on Greek debt is not politically feasible at this moment. The financial markets are still too fragile, opponents argue, warning that it could trigger a new financial crisis like the one that followed the collapse of the U.S. investment bank Lehman Brothers. Germany demands private investor participation, but the Germans have been insisting that private sector creditors must also make a contribution to overcoming the crisis. Members of parliament with the governing parties, the CDU, its Bavarian sister party, the CSU, and the FDP, recently made it clear to the government that they will reject another aid package in parliament if that doesn't happen. The chief budget expert with the CDU-CSU parliamentary group, Norbert Barthel, urged his fellow members of Parliament to act quickly. If we wait much longer, he says, there will hardly be any bonds left in the hands of private investors. Then taxpayers will end up shouldering the Greek bailout by themselves. CSU chairman Horst Schoeffer agrees wholeheartedly. He is all too familiar with the constraints imposed by the general public in Germany, the majority of whom oppose a second bailout for Greece. Experts have been telling me for a year that a restructuring of Greek debt is necessary, he says. The time has come to start involving private lenders. The government recently came up with a proposal that would involve lenders in a relatively painless fashion. They would exchange their bonds for new securities with longer maturities. The contribution by the Eurozone countries would be reduced accordingly, but with this demand, the Germans found themselves largely isolated. They were already viewed as troublemakers during the first Greek bailout when they reluctantly yielded to the will of the majority and pressure from the ECB. Now, once again, they have been pressured from all sides to go along with the majority view. That point was reached last Friday when Merkel and Sarkozy agreed to a toothless compromise in Berlin. They agreed that private lenders should be involved in the new bailout package for Greece, but only on a voluntary basis, a largely ineffective provision. This solution is much too feeble for many German parliamentarians. This is not the lender involvement that the Bundestag had demanded, says Frank Schaffler, a financial policy expert with the FDP. His CDU counterpart, Manfred Kolbe, even characterizes it as a fraudulent labeling, saying we need a debt haircut and it won't happen voluntarily. CSU European expert Thomas Silberhorn calls for binding regulations with the mandatory participation of its private investors. But from Sarkozy's standpoint, a tougher solution could jeopardize French banks. They are heavily exposed to Greek debt and could face serious difficulties. German banks and insurers unload Greek bonds. German banks and insurance companies have systematically reduced their holdings of Greek government bonds since the beginning of 2010. They have reduced their total exposure from 34.8 billion euro to 17.3 billion euro, not including debt held by the state-owned development bank, KfW. Insurance companies have reduced their investment in Greek bonds from 5.8 billion to 2.8 billion euro in the last year. In Germany, it's state-owned banks who have the greatest exposure to Greek debt. Consumer Bank, a quarter of which is owned by the federal government, holds 2.9 billion euro in Greek bonds. The state-owned regional banks, known as Landesbanken, and their so-called bad banks hold additional risk of more than €4 billion euro. Let's see here. The biggest dangers by far lurk on the books for FMS Western Management, the bad bank for the nationalized mortgage lender Hypo Real Estate. It holds Greek government bond and loans that constitute an economic risk of 10.8 billion euro. In the event of debt restructuring, taxpayers would be hardest hit in Germany. A haircut would mean that FMS loan would need several billion in fresh equity capital. ECB considers debt crisis greatest risk to banks. Now that the Germans and the French seem to be largely in agreement, they merely have to convince the ECB, the most determined opponent to date of the German proposal to require private sector involvement. The Frankfurt-based central bankers fear that this would trigger massive turmoil on the international money markets. In its new financial market stability report, the ECB categorizes the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis as the greatest risk to banks. Most of all, the ECB doesn't want investors to be forced to write off part of their debt. The monetary watchdogs warn that the consequences would be incalculable. They argue that as soon as the powerful ratings agencies gain the impression that the Greek government is not fulfilling its obligations without complete consent of its creditors, they will have to downgrade its credit rating to D, the lowest level. The letter stands for default, even if the maturities of the Greek bonds were extended with the consent of the lenders, they would have to be downgraded to a rating of SD or selective default. Either way, under its statutes, the ECB would no longer be allowed to accept such securities as collateral and returning for providing liquidity to banks. The consequences would be catastrophic. Greek banks would largely be cut off from the European money cycle and would thus run the risk of becoming illiquid. The Greek banking system would find itself on the brink of collapse, paving the path to euro bonds. This is precisely where a compromise proposal that Finance Minister Schauble plans to present to the ECB to his counterparts from the eurozone countries comes in. Under the proposal, if the Greek bonds are no longer accepted as collateral following the participation of private lenders, the ECB will simply have to be offered bonds that satisfy its requirements. A 10-member Greece task force and the German finance ministry has worked out how this could function. The experts propose that the Greek government, in addition to the 90 billion and 120 billion euro in fresh cash it may receive from the eurozone countries and the IMF as part of a second bailout, also be given access to the bonds issued by the EFSF, the Euro Rescue Fund. It could pass on these securities, which have the ratings agency's highest rating of AAA, to Greek banks, which in turn could use them as collateral to obtain liquidity from the ECB. The problem is that this measure would make the new bailout package significantly more expensive. To ensure that the EFSF had sufficient funds for the operation, the financial scope would have to be increased so that it could really make 440 billion euro available, as it was originally intended to do. To achieve this, the member states would have to double the scope of their respective guarantees. Germany, for example, would be liable for 264 billion in the future instead of the current 123 billion euro. The would-be euro rescuers are also considering accessing the so-called Hellenic Financial Stability Fund. This fund, set up as part of the first Greek bailout in May 2010, contains 10 billion euro, which could be used to boost the capital of Greek banks in an emergency. The fund hasn't been touched yet. Berlin expecting the worst. The details of the new bailout plan are to be worked out by July. This is absolutely necessary because of the next tranche of aid is not paid by mid-July, Greece will be bankrupt. Despite all of these hiccups, the money will flow to the Greeks. But no one, including the German government, believes that this will solve the problems in the eurozone. After more than a year of uninterrupted attempts at fighting the crisis, officials in Berlin are expecting the worst and intend to be ready just in case. For this reason, Schauble's crisis team has been instructed to review all possible scenarios. For example, what happens if a country can no longer meet its payment obligations or if a member leaves the monetary union? How can imbalances in a common currency zone be averted? There are essentially two alternatives. The first is a radical one in which the government pulls the governments pull the plug and leave the beleaguered countries to fend for themselves. The second, a more pragmatic solution, is to continue muddling along, though somewhat more efficiently, and to hope that things improve. Neither option will be cheap. And neither option's good. The only thing that would really work is to pull the plug. But, we can't do that. Oh, no. We can't pull the plug. The radical cure works like this. Disappointed by the lack of progress and prospects for improvement, the eurozone countries leave Greece to fend for itself. They refuse to throw even more money at Athens after all the money they have already spent. The country would quickly become insolvent because it would no longer be able to borrow any money on the markets because Greek lenders still should shoulder a substantial portion of the government debt. The country's banking sector could see a number of bankruptcies. This approach also carries with it the threat of contagion. If Greece slides into uncontrolled bankruptcies, investors might refuse to invest their money in other ailing eurozone members, even more banks could collapse in the ensuing chain reaction. The nuclear option. In light of these incalculable developments, many are now considering the nuclear option as a real alternative. Greece withdraws from the monetary union and reintroduces the drachma. The government in Athens was already toying with the idea weeks ago, and now even internationally respected economists are recommending it. A withdrawal from the euro would be the lesser of two evils, says Hans Werner Sinn, head of the respected Munich-based IFO Institute for Economic Research. Noriel Rabini, an economist at New York University, also supports the idea. The renowned professor argues Greece's only chance is to devalue its own currency and thus improve its competitiveness. Rabini was one of the few to predict a financial crisis 3 years ago. In every financial crisis to date, it has taken the devaluation of the currency to reinvigorate the economy of a crisis-stricken country, Rabini argues. But historic examples can only be applied to the conditions in the monetary union to a limited extent. The crisis would not end after Greece's withdrawal. In fact, it could even get worse. The country's debts would still be denominated in euros, which would in turn, turn them into foreign currency debts overnight. Their value in a new currency, a new national currency, would rise rapidly because the drachma would be devalued. Greek borrowers would all but be unable to meet their obligations. Banks, in turn, would come under pressure both in Greece and the rest of the Eurozone, and costly bailout measures for the banking industry would be needed once again. At the end of such a development, the monetary union could disintegrate into a hard currency block and a group of with its own weaker currencies. Critics of the common currency, like former Bundesbank board member Wilhelm Noling, favor such a solution. Noling and a group of like-minded people once filed and lost suit in the introduction of the euro before the German Federal Constitutional Court, and now he is suing the government once again over the euro bailout fund. The court's decision is still pending. The alternative is the breakup of the monetary union is hardly any less threatening, leading as it does directly to a transfer union. After a year of Greek bailouts, the beginning is already underway, and starting in 2013, the planned permanent bailout fund, the ESM, which EU finance ministers approved on Monday, will be yet another step on this dangerous path. Echoes of Italy's Mezzogiorno and Belgium's Wallonia. The end result could look something like this. The deficit countries would require permanent financing from the more stable north. What was treated as a loan in the past would be transformed into a subsidy, and thus requiring neither interest nor repayment. The monetary union would become a financial union, and the debtor countries the permanent recipients of subsidies, depending on contributions from their economically more powerful neighbors, much like Mezzogiorno in Italy or Belgium's Wallonia region. To prevent this from happening, many politicians specializing in financial and economic affairs recommend bringing about the political union of Europe as quickly as possible, a union with strong central government. Basically, it could make it more of a dictatorship. They argue that if the nations in the Eurozone formed a closer union, they could coordinate their financial system more effectively, thus providing the common currency with a political foundation. This would make it easier to implement reforms in the recipient countries, a better dictatorship, and improve their competitiveness. Just recently, ECB President Jean-Claude Trichet proposed installing a European finance ministry equipped with the right to intervene in the individual member states. There you go. Enforce the dictatorship. Make it a more efficient dictatorship. We'll force it to work. A cautionary tale in German reunification. But it isn't quite that easy. More integration doesn't necessarily mean that economic imbalances would disappear as a result. No one understands this better than the Germans, who had similar experiences with a monetary union between the two Germanies about 20 years ago. Effectively July 1, 1990, the Deutschmark became the official currency of East Germany. It was largely exchanged for the former East German mark at a ratio of 1 to 1. The East German states joined the Federal Republic of Germany only 3 months later. It was a model case of a monetary union that was accompanied by a political union. But anyone who believed that the rapid unification would lessen the economic shock of the monetary union between the two Germanies was soon disappointed. In fact, the economic imbalances in reunified Germany became entrenched after that. Thousands of companies in the former East Germany went out of business because they were unable to bring productivity up to Western standards. The unemployment figures exploded, and financial transfers between the two parts of the country soon exceeded the trillion mark. To this day, the former East German states still lag behind the former West German states in terms of economic strength, productivity, and income. German reunification did nothing to change this. It merely helped to financially cushion the negative consequences of the monetary union. The states of the former East Germany were incorporated into West Germany, into the West German Interstate Fiscal Adjustment System, under which money is transferred from richer to poorer states and under favorable terms, and the former East Germans were suddenly given access to the blessings of the generous West German social system. The lesson is clear. German unification is not a valid role model for European politicians, but rather a cautionary tale. It shows how quickly a poorly designed monetary union can lead to a permanent transfer union. Such a model would in any case be incompatible with the European treaties. New agreements would have to be negotiated and ratified by all national parliaments and perhaps even approved in referendums. But perhaps the people of Europe and their representatives will decide the fate of the monetary union first. It could happen in Athens or in Lisbon if the necessary reforms fail as a result of popular protest, or in Berlin, should the billions in loan guarantees actually come due. You know, so all these experts, you know, this expert, that economist, that university, all of these people think that they can engineer, they're going to engineer things and they're going to engineer people and kind of make them all, everything all equal and everything's going to be hunky-dory, and it doesn't work that way. You cannot engineer people. You know, what you need to do, if you have enough genuine people in a society, then the society, you know, those people are going to be able to kind of magically do things on their own. And things just kind of work out. But if you have people that have been kind of dysfunctionalized, I'm seeing lightning off to the north actually right now. Otherwise, it's been clear, but you have people that have been kind of dysfunctionalized, and they're suggestible, and then you have, and then of course you always have people that want to rule over other people and kind of dominate them, and so you have these experts and, you know, all these people that worm their way into positions of power in the government and academia. They think that they can just take these suggestible people and engineer some sort of utopia, and it can't be done. And then they want more and more and more power. They try harder and harder to force these people to do, you know, to try to force them into making their engineered systems work, and they just, it just creates greater and greater and greater messes. And you know, so you can't, but I mean, just on the face of it, you can't borrow more money and, you know, and try to bail out a failed state, or, you know, or try to bail out a someone that's just spending money like crazy. You can't do it. You know, I was you know, my parents are here. My mom, you know, has long been a liberal, and she's got all these ideas. And I ended up, you know, I did not start the conversation. She was the one that kind of instigated it. And, you know, she was talking about bailouts and, you know, just kind of in general, with what was going on with the economy and Wall Street and blah. And, of course, she's all mad at Wall Street or whatever, kind of falling into the general trap of kind of being angry with certain people. Or, you know, all the jobs have gone to China, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I ask her a simple question. Where does the value of money come from? The woman's 86 years old. She said, does it come from gold? No. The value of money comes from people working. The value of money comes from people, you know, because gold would be worthless unless, you know, people valued it, unless people do something with it. You know, you can have all kinds of natural resources, and unless you do something with them, they're worthless. You know, you can have a, you know, an entire, for example, you could have an entire lumber yard worth of 2x4s and 2x6s and 2x8s and nails and all of the things that are in a lumber yard, but they'd be perfectly worthless unless you have the labor of the people to build things out of them, do things with them. And that's just a small example. And, you know, and then I the conversation, you know, I was trying to get her to, you know, and she tried changing the subject, you know, the conversation kind of, you know, we were talking about debt, and I tried to get her to think of it this way, you know, how can you, if you as a, and I used her, you know, my parents as an example, you know, I said, what would be, you know, what's your income for the month? And she, you know, she kind of told him, hawed around, and she told me, and of course she knows, but, and it's not a secret, but so anyway, and then I said, well, let's multiply that, and let's say that, you know, this is your income, whatever it is, and let's say you're going to spend $18,000 a month, you know, but their income is not $18,000, you know, it's way less than that, but, you know, I multiplied it several times. Let's say that, you know, you're going to spend $18,000 a month, and you're going to do it for as long as you possibly can. You know, you're going to just, you know, get whatever credit resources you can possibly muster, and you're to spend $18,000 a month, even though your income is way, way less than, is only a fraction of that. How long could you do that? How long could you borrow money, just borrow, beg, steal, you know, to be able to spend $18,000 a month? She said, maybe for a couple of months. Well, that's what our government's doing. Except they also print money. Can't sustain it. It can't go on. You ultimately have people working, and you have people that aren't working, and people that have kind of been dysfunctionalized, people that are slaves, that are not genuine, that are dysfunctional, that don't produce anything. Especially the people that don't, you got more and more people that don't produce and fewer people that actually do produce. And that's an equation that can't be sustained. It can't. It can't go on like that. And so I was kind of, I don't know, I'm not going to change her mind because she's got, you can try to persuade people and they'll end up kind of, maybe, you know, they'll go back to whatever they thought, you know, just come back a day or two later and they think the same way. But, you know, it's kind of a weird, you know, there's this weird disconnect, you know, because you can understand it. You know, she understands very well, you know, you don't spend more than you make or that you take in. You don't, you know, you can't do that for long, but when it comes to the government, you know, it's just like it's somehow some other magic, and it's somebody else's fault, and the money's going to come from somewhere. And but I don't know, this thing with Greece is a great example, because You know, they lied to kind of get in the European Union in the first place, and then they got all this welfare, and now they can't pay it back. Now, you know, and then that brings up another point. You know, people always want to yoke someone that really produces to some, you know, to, you know, let's say a group of people that really produce, to kind of tie them together with people that don't produce as much. You know, and there are people, I'm sure, that thought, well, it's just not fair that these Greeks, this Greek economy just isn't producing as much as the German economy does. And so let's take money from the Germans and you know, kind of force them to improve the Greeks' lifestyle is basically what's gone on. And, you know, kind of an artificial way, and rather than just, you know, they were better off when they were just individual countries. And then if an individual country, you know, got out of control, and, you know, there were always mechanisms to, as that article was kind of alluding to, there are always mechanisms where they could kind of get rein things back in and get them back under control. But this Euro thing is basically, it's a dictatorship. It's an artificial construct. It's sort of like it's kind of like a Soviet Union in a way, where you take all these countries and try to force them together into a unit, a political economic unit, and it was horrible, because it was all revolved around slavery, and it won't work. It's not sustainable. It won't function. Can't work. So, but I don't know. It's interesting. So, anyhow, probably better be cutting this off. I'm seeing more and more lightning, so we may be getting some rain before this is all over with, or probably a thunderstorm. So, in any case, hope everyone is having a great week so far. Hope that you haven't had too much wind blowing in the microphone. I tried to, you know, I've got the little microphone cover on here, a little foam microphone cover, so that it should try to protect it, but some of the gusts of wind have been pretty strong. So, but in any case, I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.